And in Assume the Position this week, we're chatting to Candice Knight and Richie Blackmore, aka Blackmore's Knight, who released their latest album in September, All Our Yesterdays. And with the news that Richie's going to be playing selected dates, including the UK, in June of next year, cranking out the old Strat again, we'll be chatting about how Blackmore's Knight fits into the grand scheme of things, and also playing tracks from not only the new album, but also some of their albums since the late 1990s.
Get ready to rock with David Randall. Playing all the best in rock music. Just for you.
Thank you.
And here at Get Ready to Rock, we're saying hello to a rock legend and Candice Knight from Blackmore's Night. Hello to Richie and to Candice.
Hello, Candy.
Hello, Richie. Hello, Dave.
It's a three-way conversation, and we're really...
That sounds rather rude.
Well, we're really excited to catch up with you shortly after the release of the brand new album. We started off the show with Will of the Wisp. Great track too. Now, okay. Now you'll both want to probably contribute to this, because I want to go right back to the 1980s when you first met up together. Tell us how that came about, and you know, what were the circumstances
of meeting each other? Was I played in a charity match, soccer match, and against the local radio station here in Long Island, CAB. And what I said to them was, look, it would be, I think it was Purple at the time. I said, it would be some people from Deep Purple and some Rainbow, and we'll have a charity match. I said, don't get anybody too good on the field, because, you know, we're getting older, and we're just, we play for fun. So naturally, they took me at my word and turned up with all the DJs from the station who were absolutely useless. And I imported all my, the soccer team that I used to play with up in Connecticut. So we had all the ringers, and they had DJs. I think they had one good player. They should have had Candy playing, but she was just there in the crowd, and I spoke to her later. And, of course, she was shining with her usual looks and everything. So after that, we went for drinks, many drinks, till 4 in the morning, drinking whiskey, of which she never drinks, but she kept up. I think she was pouring the drinks away into a flower. Bars, weren't you, or something?
You'll never know that secret. Yeah. I'll never tell you how I kept up with it.
And that, so that's very briefly what happened. It was a soccer match, of all things.
Right.
You can football now, because you're speaking to England.
Of course, I have to say
so
soccer.
You have to say soccer here.
I have to say soccer here, because over here, what football is, someone running along with a helmet and with a ball in their hand.
It's great, though, because we have two children now, a three-year-old and a five-year-old, and we say they're bilingual, because they can actually speak English and American. They're two totally different languages, so they understand Daddy when he speaks in his you know, lingo, and then have to understand Mommy for American as well.
Well, look, Candy, what going back to that time that Richie's just described, what were your thoughts on Richie as a musician? I mean, what did you think of, going back to Deep Purple and all that? How did you regard him? Did you regard the meeting with a little bit of...
Trepidation
is a good word. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, honestly, when I first met him, I was familiar with the songs I knew on the radio, having worked for a radio station, of course, and been such a music fan for so many years. I am almost embarrassed to say at that point that I didn't have any Deep Purple albums in my collection, although I knew all of the songs that were being played. But I did have quite a few Rainbow albums. Namely, many of the Ronnie Dio albums with Richie, obviously, were being played very, very often in my house. But
not on the radio.
Well, no, that's true. But ironically, after I met Richie and he asked me for drinks later on, and we went to that pub and spoke until all hours of the morning. And funny enough, we didn't speak about music at all. I think we spoke about pretty much everything else, about history and traveling and geography and paranormal and supernatural and so many different levels which we connected on, and we really didn't talk much about music, which was my passion, but I guess he at that point I think he just wasn't into talking about what he had done for a living for so many years. So but as soon as I left there the next day, I actually went to a local record store and I went out and bought almost all of his albums so I could study up and verse myself on it next time, if there was a next time at that point.
You realize, Candy, who it was you've been talking to.
Well, I had studied on it, and it still never came up, because at that point he was into Renaissance music.
Oh, yes. Well,
all that studying really did me no good at all whatsoever.
Well, let's have a track from the 2003 Blackmore's Night album, Ghost of a Rose. It's the track Diamonds and Rust.
You know, Richie and I, once a week, we have this gathering that we do with all of our friends, our closest, most intimate friends. We go to a local pub down here, a restaurant pub. It's very woody, very haunted, very dark. They keep the back room open for us, and we just invite our friends. Everybody brings acoustic instruments. We pass the instruments around. Everybody gets their chance at singing songs, original songs that they've written, old songs, new favorites. And really, that's how we wind up finding a lot of these older songs that we wind up covering, because they held a very special place in our heart at one point, and then I guess a couple of decades in, we've kind of forgotten somewhat about them. And then when we hear them again, it's that nostalgic memory of, oh, I loved that song. Whatever happened to that? And so we start playing them again. Diamonds and Rust was one of those songs, originally written by Joan Baez, supposedly about her relationship with Bob Dylan. And we had a friend of ours who was from Estonia, and she picked up the guitar and started singing it in this incredible, heart-wrenching voice. And it was just so beautiful, really just so soul-stirring. And it really just grabbed us, and we thought maybe, you know, we could do it again and do it live. And again, it's one of those songs that just transports you, and once you start singing it and performing it, it kind of becomes your own. And you just close your eyes and feel those words, and it's a very emotional song.
Here comes your ghost again. That's not unusual. It's just that the moon is full and you happen to call. And here I sit, my hand on the telephone, hearing a voice of light years ago, heading straight for a fall. As I remember, your eyes were bluer than robin's eggs. My poetry was lousy, said. Where are you calling from? Years ago, I bought you some cufflinks. When you brought me something, we both know what memories can bring. They bring diamonds and rocks. On the scene, already a legend, the unwashed phenomenon, the original vagabond, straight into my arms. And there you stayed, temporarily lost at sea. The Madonna was yours for free. It's the girl on the half shell. Keep you on high. Now I see you standing with leaves falling around and snow in your hair. Now you're smiling out the window of that hotel over Washington Square. Your breath comes out white clouds and mingles and hangs in the air. Speaking strictly for me, both could have died then and there. Now you're telling me you're not nostalgic. Well, then give me another word for it. You are always so good with words, and at keeping things vague. Cause I need some of that vagueness, now it's all coming back too clearly. Oh, I loved you dearly. If you're offering me
the first time I think you collaborated on at least on an album with Richie was the Rainbow album back in 1995. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I feel like our relationship has really taken a very natural evolution. Yeah, when we first met, obviously we were just friends, and then it's like any relationship. We were friends. The friendship grew into a romantic relationship. But then he brought me on the road with him in 93, which was to be the last time he played with Deep Purple. And I was always singing, like, in the shower and around the hotel room. And so at that point, he asked me to sing background vocals on his Difficult to Cure solo, which began, I think, in Czechoslovakia at that point. It was still Czechoslovakia. And they hid me behind amplifiers and curtains so nobody would see me there, just set up a little microphone. So that's how our singing, my singing with Richie began. And then when he left Purple and reformed Rainbow, what happened was the guys were in a farmhouse in Massachusetts in about 6 feet of snow, and I think they had a hard time, the singer was having a hard time coming up with fresh lyrics that would please Richie and the producer. So I was always a closet poet. I didn't really show my writings to anyone, but Richie had called me up on the phone while the guys were working up there and played. I was on the ferry. He played some songs to me, a backing track. And I was taking the ferry up to visit them anyway. It takes an hour and 15 minutes on the ferry with nothing to do but look at the water and the sky. And I was able to just absorb the track he played for me. And I came up with about 14 verses on that ride up. And I just handed my paper, my notebook and pen over to the producer and to Richie. And they circled four verses. And the fifth one they put together of mine to make into the chorus. And that song became Black Masquerade. So, as soon as they knew I could do that, they decided not to fly in a special lyric writer, which was on the books. They were about to do that, and they canceled his flight. And they had me write the lyrics of four of the tracks on Stranger in a Saul: Ariel, Wolf to the Moon, Black Masquerade, and Hall of the Mountain King. And then because I was around and I could carry a tune, I wound up doing the backing vocals as well. So that's really how our whole the whole writing progression started between me and Richie, and our professional relationship as well as what we do now.
Yeah. Okay, from Stranger in a Soul 1995, this is Black Masquerade. Now, it wasn't until 1997 that you released the debut Blackmore's Night album, but you've already indicated there, Candy, that, you know, it wasn't long after you first met Richie in the late 80s. You had this common bond of a love of Renaissance music and early music. I assume also you were very aware yourself personally that Richie had become a little bit disenchanted with the world of rock music.
Yeah, well, I think I was able to see that the most when, I guess there was two things that kind of really come to my mind. When he would step off the stage with, being on stage with Purple in 93, and he was so frustrated that there were so many things, and he so many things going wrong, and I realized that he was getting a lot of that inspiration that for his writing and stage performance from Friction. And which is great for a stage performance, but I think after doing it for about 40 years at that point, it starts to wear on somebody's soul. You know, you start to watch them deteriorate before your eyes, and especially when you care about somebody, you know, you're there for them as a shoulder to lean on, but it's hard to watch. So when he decided to leave that band and reform Rainbow, and then at that point in 95, the corporate world of rock and roll had become the corporate world. It wasn't what he started off with. It wasn't, you know, the late 60s, and it wasn't where you could have your own individuality and personality in a band, and as soon as you turned on the radio, you knew whether it was Procol Harum or Jethro Tull or Jimi Hendrix or Cream or Purple, and the album, the bands were so different sounding, and they just wore those, you know, their individuality so proudly, and they had their own personalities. They were amazing, as well as obviously the musicality. The musicianship was incredible standard. The writing was amazing. But going into the 90s, we started getting into record companies that said, oh, you know what, send me a demo and I'll let you know if you're in the right direction or not. Or I'll let you know if I want this this title to be used. And Richie's going, I haven't made a demo since I was 19. Like, why would I do? So watching how, you know, the clutches of the corporation started really squeezing all of the creativity out of rock and roll at that point, it was a different world. And for him to get involved with that, or, you know, continue his involvement with that, I think it was really, you know, disheartening. It was really very difficult to watch him go through that. So while he was watching all of that going on and hearing these messages from the record label, and I don't think he was 100% really pleased in the direction that he was going in, he and I would be sitting by a raging fireplace while the other band members were doing their tracks for the Stranger in Us All album. And he would have an acoustic guitar. We would be watching the fire or the snow coming down outside and just playing acoustically and singing acoustic, you know, just the two of us. Just as an escape, I think, from what the rock and roll world had become at that point. So, I mean, he'd been doing it, like I said, for decades. So this was really kind of his escape from the stress and pressures of his work life, just like everybody else needs an escape from the pressures of their work, you know, what they do. But I think Blackmore's Night really began as a stress reliever and an escape from the pressures that he was feeling in his work at that point, which wound up being the rock and roll world. And we really never thought that we would be putting our albums out for anybody until the record label from Japan asked us for a copy, and we sent over what we had put down, just the acoustic versions, and some of our friends heard it, and they said, you know what, if we heard this out on, you know, on the radio or heard this album, we would go out and buy it. And the Japanese record label said, we would like to put it out. And they were really the first ones that backed us and had the idea of standing behind the Blackmore's Night music and putting it out for the world to hear. So I guess we're kind of really indebted to them for opening that path for us. And the journey continues. It's been 17 years.
Yes, that's right. Well, let's play a track from that first album back in 1997 featuring Ian Anderson. And it's Play, Minstrel, Play.
Shadows will play and hide with the ghostly tune. I'm the devil's bride. Stranger whispered all the town as he comes to save us from Satan's hand, leading them away to a foreign land. Pray for me, Mr. Gray. Take away our sorrows. Pray for me, Mr. Gray, and the fire. is we should have seen it from far away, wearing such a thin disguise in the light of day. We held the answer to our prayers, yet it was too good to be proof before our very eyes, yet we could not see.
As you say, Candy, you've been making albums since the late 1990s. Do you ever sense, or have you ever sensed, maybe in the earlier days, a certain, I think you're probably going to anticipate what I'm going to ask you, you know, a certain resentment from certain quarters that you may be partially responsible for stealing Richie away from his Fender Strat and all those heavy riffs? I mean, how did you deal with that?
Oh, that's the old Yoko Ono syndrome, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's a very good comparison, actually, where you've got your partner, either male or female, you know, influencing. You know, I was just wondering how you coped with that in the very early days.
Well, you know, it's such a funny thing, because when we originally did our first track, in all honesty, I had never heard Renaissance music or medieval music or really any folky music before I met Richie. And when he swept me off my feet and took me to his big old place in his English Tudor house, the very dark English Tudor house in the woods in Connecticut, where he lived for a while with me. He was living up there before I met him, so when we went up there, he would only be playing Renaissance music in the house. And any time I would take the tape off, back then there was tapes, take the tape off and put on one of the songs that I liked or the 80s music that I was interested in, he would take my tapes off and kind of hide them on me and put Renaissance music back on. So it was really the saturation of, you know, of Renaissance music into my life was all from Richie. So the tables were completely turned from what normal from what people probably think they were in the first place. But, you know, after that, I really started really enjoying and listening to them and looking out the window. I think my favorite moment was looking out the window and listening to the Renaissance music behind me and really seeing that as the soundtrack to nature. It all clicked at that moment for me. Him playing that on the sound system and just watching the outside, the incredible changings of the leaves or the buds coming out in the spring or the snow in the winter, and hearing this music, it was the perfect marriage of visual to audio. And it all made sense at that point. And I'm obviously a big nature fan. So anytime I would go for a walk through the woods, I would have my headphones on and be listening to that style of music. But again, through the introduction of Richie to that world. So I understand people saying that. But in all honesty, the truth is that he brought me into this Renaissance world. It wasn't the other way around.
No, it's interesting you say that. Yeah.
The other point is, as far as the Yoko Ono thing is, I don't know much about all that, but I have to say, I've never seen John Lennon more happy than when he's with Yoko Ono. So, you know, from whenever, you know, obviously everybody loves the Beatles and what they were, but, you know, when they got to a certain point and then she came along and you see the two of them so happy together, it's like, if you're there for him as a person, as opposed to an icon of what he could provide to the world musically, then I don't know, maybe she had a good point just being there for him as an artist and making him happy.
Yes. Now, over the period of almost, well, 20 years or so, really, how did you soon, you know, how did you start to pick up fans? Because I assume in the early days, Candy, there might have been those fans who didn't really get Blackmore's Night, for various reasons. But those that did get Blackmore's Night could enter into a semi-fantasy world. They could dress up in fancy costumes and, I have to be honest, enjoy a damn good pint of grog.
Pint of anything, probably.
Yeah.
As long as it's
but did you find it was fairly easy to, and you've got really a real hardcore of genuinely enthusiastic fans behind you, really?
We do. We're very lucky. We find that our most loyal fans come upon us when it's word of mouth, when it's spread word of mouth, where they somehow discover us. Obviously, we're never going to get the big mainstream promotions of anything, so not with this style of music, but we find that the people that are really into what's being pushed on mainstream are really more into fashion and fad and kind of, you know, following trends. And the people that follow us are much more independent thinkers. They're kind of looking for something different that they aren't brainwashed by listening 1,800 times a day on one station to. Huh. So when people kind of discover us, they discover us for life. They stay with us. And we've also found, you know, the people who were Richie's fans from the beginning and are only into hard rock, they have a tendency either to have never heard of our band. They immediately don't want to hear it because they assume that it's like a two-piece lute-playing Renaissance band, which obviously it's not. But, you know, we're an eight-piece band, and obviously Richie's still playing electric and has never stopped. It's just not all he plays at this point. But so a lot of those people either have never heard of us, you know, what we do, or they've heard it in the very, very beginning stages and said, well, that's not for me, and kind of walked away from it. But the interesting thing with that is that a lot of the people who have followed Richie from the beginning, whether it's from the 60s or 70s, a lot of the men especially, they know that Richie's name is synonymous with Blackmore Brilliance. So whether it's going to be on electric, acoustic, hurdy-gurdy, mandola, mandolin, he's going to play it in an incredible way that you've never heard it before. And it's always amazing because it's simply because it's Richie and it's his, you know, his heart and his soul coming through, channeling through those fingers and that guitar. So the men are there, whether, you know, a lot of the men, the fans who have been there since the beginning, and they've gotten a little bit older, so their musical tastes have matured, and they're okay with melody without it being super hard rock, you know. But then now they're married, and their wives really like the female vocalists. They love the lyric telling, the storytelling of legends and myths and fairy tales and romance and nature-based, and they like dressing up. And then they have children, so their children come, and they still have that innocence where they like to dress up. The girls are little fairies or princesses, and the little boys are Robin Hood or knights in shining armor. And they come, and these are easy songs to sing along to for the children. So Under a Violet Moon, Toast to Tomorrow, they get involved with all of the choruses, and we're watching the whole family sing. And then the grandparents come because they get a little tired of just listening to the same Tony Bennett album again and again, and they're looking for more softer melodic music. So of course Blackmore's Night has that style for them as well. So it becomes really an incredible family show. So I would say our fan base is actually almost like fivefold, as opposed to the one guy who would normally come and you know, and judge the band cross-armed and say it's either good or it's not, because it's not hard enough or heavy enough for him. Now we've got full families out there, and it's just really wonderful to see that it's positivity. They're walking out smiling, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful night when we come to town to play.
Oh, yeah. It's a really wide demographic from what you're saying, isn't it? Let's have another track from the brand new album, and this is, I have to say, a little bit more conventional in terms of what we may or may not expect from Richie over the years. This is Darker Shade of Black. Thank you. be the Ritchie Blackmore that we all know and love. More familiar, perhaps, and a track off the Blackmore's Night album, All Our Yesterdays, out now via Frontiers Records. We're chatting to Candice Knight and Ritchie Blackmore here on Get Ready to Rock Radio. Now, let's go back in time to an album that came out around about 2013, and it sort of sums up, really, the Renaissance style that the band have been trailblazing since the late 90s, at least in the world of rock music. And from the album Dancer and the Moon, this is Galliard. What did you find fascinating about, you know, that period of music?
So much to love about Renaissance music. Just hearing those organic instruments, you know, the hurdy-gurdies and the nickel harps, the shawms, to me they're very exciting. You know, the same way that the electric guitar was when I was 13. If I would hear Cliff Gallup or Scotty Moore, Elvis Presley fame, if I heard the guitar for the first time, it's very exciting. So it's the intervals and the way they play, the harmonic structure, I find very appealing. And it's not made to a formula like the music is today. Everything today has to have a dance beat. You know, otherwise, many people just don't want to hear it. It's not 120 beats per minute. It's very refreshing, and it's natural, and it just seems honest and pure from the heart. Whereas, like I said, today's music to me comes across as being contrived, and it's more important to be famous than it is to play good music. And I think that's the ruination of a lot of music today. Plus, you've got most radio stations will only follow a formula, something that they think will be contemporary and popular. So I hope you haven't turned off by now.
Oh, yeah. No. We're very eclectic here, actually. But, I mean, I was chatting with Jan Ackerman, you know, from Focus several years back.
Yeah. And
yes. Now, of course, he, you know, he was very much into, you know, medieval Renaissance music, released the album Tabernacle. But I have to say, Ritchie, just as an aside, he was really impressed with what you've achieved, really, in terms of widening the audience for early music, in terms of a rock audience, you know, widening
the
scope.
A big compliment coming from him, because he's a very accomplished musician, and he took up the lute, and he's very good. He's excellent on the lute, too.
I think he saw you as a kindred spirit, somebody who a bit like Candy, really, you discover the intricacies of the music.
Candy from a certain angle. Yeah.
Well, look, it's been fascinating chatting. I hope we can take this up very shortly and talk in a little bit more depth, Richie, about your own career from way back when. We're going to play out with a track from the brand new album, and I think I'm right in saying this is a remake of a track that first appeared on Ghost of a Rose. At least it sounds very similar. It's a little bit faster, I think, isn't it?
Where are we going from here?
Yes.
That's a very old type of melody, yes, which is kind of sums up, I know it sums up my life. Where the hell am I going from here? Most of us wonder about where we're going in life.
Yes. You know, we're talking now in late October. There is talk around that, you know, Richie's going to make a bit of a comeback in terms of the rock music. Do you ever feel that that's always like background pressure, really, because he can do that if he wants to do it? And how does this impact on Blackmore's Night?
I don't think it impacts on it at all. What we do is so completely different than what Richie's done in the past with the other bands. So that's why I always say I would never say I could ever fill the shoes of any of those other singers, obviously, you know, Ian Gillan, Ronnie Dio, any of them. But they can't fill my stiletto heels either, so I guess it works out that way.
I really don't feel pressure
because it's like apples and oranges. It's so different. But I'm supportive of Richie, whatever direction and decision he wants to do. I'm excited that he's going to do rock again, but I also know that his love for Blackmore's Night and the Renaissance music and what we do is so pure and so strong. So I know he's only doing a few of the rock shows, and maybe he'll do a few more later on if it goes well, but we're going to do Blackmore's Night right after those rock shows as well, so we've got a tour coming up right after that, so he's never too far from home.
Oh, that's really great. Well, look, to both of you, it's been a pleasure to chat with you today, and all the very best in the coming months, and we hope to catch up with you again soon as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.